It is 8:31, and we have with us live in the studios once again, John Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat This Steak. Good morning.
Good morning to you. Welcome back, Maria.
Yep. Thank you.
Good to have you back.
It's good to be here.
Well, we got plenty to cover here. I didn't really ask you where we were going to start.
We're going to start with Marie and then go local.
Okay. We can do that.
Start with what?
Marie Bernard. She was a peace activist well known around the community who passed away about, a week ago Friday. And she will be missed. And that's really about all there is to say. She was very active with Ground Zero, Center for Nonviolent Action, and with SNO and some other peace groups around town. Had been active for probably 40 years or so in the Seattle area with various nonviolent activist groups. The Washington Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty. She was a board member there for a number of years. Anyway, she was very well known, and she will be missed by a lot of people. And that's really about all there is to say.
Yeah, in fact, I think she participated in the MLK.
Yes, she was arrested.
Demonstration at Ground Zero.
Even though she was in poor health, she was arrested at Ground Zero on MLK Day on January 15th, and obviously won't be serving any jail sentences as a result of that.
One way to escape jail time, I suppose.
Yes, but
not the best way.
No, she died of congestive heart failure on. A week ago, and I believe there was a memorial service. There was one that was held last weekend, and there was another one that's going to be held, I believe, out at Ground Zero today. So,
all right. Well, Seattle schools, they have got some schools marked for closing?
Yeah. Raj Manas, the superintendent, came forward with his requested proposal for closing schools, and also, although it didn't get nearly as much attention, an additional part of the overall proposal was to cut down on the crosstown,
busing.
The busing, the cluster plan that's used right now of transporting students to schools is going to be dropped. That was part of the plan also. That hasn't gotten nearly as much attention or as fire as the closing of the schools. And it's an interesting list of 10 schools, primarily because the schools targeted, by and large, are small schools. And this is a mixed blessing because you're trying to look for cost savings, obviously, but you're also looking for academic performance. And a lot of these small schools, North Beach Elementary has gotten a lot of attention, for example, are very good schools because they're small, because the parents are involved, because there's a small class size and this kind of thing. Beyond that, a number of alternative programs are going to be closed or moved. The two Montessori programs in the school district, one at Bagley was going to be moved to Greenwood Elementary, and then at MLK Elementary was going to start Montessori this coming year, and that's going to be closed entirely. The John Marshall Alternative High School is going to be closed. The Summit
K through 12
Alternative School is going to be closed. So there's a lot of those types of programs are programs that have very vocal constituents, have a lot of support in the community. So we're going to see a real battle over some of these school closings. In fact, a lot of the parents are already organizing fairly actively. So I would say if you're concerned about the school closings, make your voice heard, because this will not be the final plan. This will not be the final configuration. But it's hard to imagine with a $20 million budget shortfall and the enrollment of the district down nearly half, I believe, over the last 20 years. It's hard to imagine that there won't be at least some school closings. The dynamics of the school district as well as the finances demand it. But whether these will be the actual schools to be closed is another question, because I think there will be a lot of heated battles and a lot of parents mobilizing pretty actively to try and save some of these schools from closing.
And hopefully some of these alternative programs. The interesting thing about trying to move an alternative program from one school to another kind of strikes me as weird, because, as you know, the alternative programs that succeed the most are the ones that have the most parent involvement. In other words, they're rooted in the community. So when you rip it out of the community and try to transplant it somewhere else, that's really a, sort of a death sentence for that alternative program. You can't always make it work.
Well, particularly in the case of the Montessori at Bagley, because that's a mixture of Montessori and traditional, and they're moving the Montessori component, but not the traditional. So
yeah, I don't see how that's going to work.
So it really isn't moving the actual program as it now exists. It's moving one component of it, which
doesn't make any sense.
You're right. So and then there's another program, it may look good on paper, but it doesn't make sense.
The Orca program
at Columbia, I believe, is also going to be moved. That school is going to be closed as well. So a lot of these alternative programs need to be fought for. They need to be saved, and they need to be saved if possible in their current locations.
Yeah, and I mean, the school district should be looking at this. You know, if you're going to restructure the system, well, why don't we try to move these types of models to other schools instead of trying to just move things around, shift things around as far as demographics are concerned? Why not adopt these models in other schools and look at, well, is there an economic way to make these small schools still run, you know, and to maybe take this smaller model to other schools? You know, you would think that if they were going to do a system-wide restructuring with an eye towards cost saving, that they wouldn't just say, okay, we got to close the small schools. I don't see how that's going to save them a lot of money, especially when they start having to move students around and incorporate them in other schools, which will be costly.
And I'm not entirely sure, although I'm certainly willing to be corrected on this, but I'm not entirely sure that closing the smallest schools is that much more of a cost savings than closing some of the mid-sized ones.
Maybe their performance levels are not that good.
Yeah, exactly.
I want to remind people that we will, if time permits, take your questions via email, which is dj@kexp.org, as well as you can put in questions for next week. We won't be able to get to them this week via the phone, 206-520-5838. All right. Well, and speaking of financial cuts, at least that appears to be the excuse. They're looking at lifeguard cutbacks at a beach in South Seattle.
Yeah, Pritchard Beach. Pritchard Beach was denied lifeguard service a couple of years ago, and they're trying to get it reinstated this year in Mayor Greg Nickel's budget. It's the only beach in Seattle that does not have lifeguard service.
About how much would it cost to provide?
About $40,000, which in the context of a city budget is peanuts.
It's literally nickels.
Yeah. It is, particularly when you're talking about the kind of money that's being thrown at, say, a trolley for South Lake Union.
To increase the value of Mayor Nichols' investments.
Yeah, but the remarkable thing about this is that the lifeguard services at Pritchard Beach, when they had been installed, were used more heavily than they had been used at any other city beach in Seattle. So the people in Southeast Seattle are seeing this almost as sort of a racist or classist kind of thing, where the typical thing in the South End, the lives just aren't as valuable. This is how it's being perceived. You're getting city council members are being lobbied, and community members are kind of up in arms about this and trying to get the city hall's attention and get lifeguard service restored at Pritchard Beach.
Wow, 40,000. I mean, you could just take, like, let's say the one of the mayor's assistants said 136,000, cut it back to 90, and you'd have it.
You would.
Yeah. Or maybe cut the mayor's salary back a little bit.
There you go.
And I believe the mayor's office actually has increased its own budget quite a bit since Nichols has come into office.
All right. Well, speaking of budgets, the legislature was wrestling with those. Any forward movement on that?
They were. And this week, just yesterday, in fact, they managed to reconcile two bills that had been passed, one through the House and one through the Senate. This reconciled bill then has to be passed by both houses again, and it goes to the governor for her signature. They've made some pretty good changes to
all
the budget.
All of which has to happen by Sunday night.
Yeah, in 2 days, which it may or may not happen. We'll see. It's a good step forward that they actually got the bill reconciled and are ready to look at it at the final version. So hopefully they'll have something and won't have to go into overtime, which is what would happen if they didn't come up with a budget plan. The mayor would have to declare a special session and then go into overtime.
The governor
would have to declare a special session and they'd go into overtime. The interesting thing that they're still wrestling about is a transportation plan, just like every year. This year, the proposal is to increase the gas tax by about 9.5 cents over the course of about 4 or 5 years. I don't see how this is going to be very helpful. For one thing, the gas tax is not indexed to inflation, so it's not a permanent solution. It'll provide some money, but not all of the money, for major transportation projects like replacing the Alaskan Way Viaduct and the 520 Bridge. The bulk of the money still is not there, even if this plan passes. And much of the projects that are being funded in the plan are relying on the proposals rely on a regional transportation package passing in the Tri-County area of Snohomish, King, and Pierce County. Now, if you've been listening to our program for a while and been following what we've been saying about the Regional Transportation Board, you'll realize that...
for like the last 5 years.
Yeah, that's been kind of twiddling their thumbs for several years. You'll realize that that is not something that may actually happen. So I don't see how this is a solution, and I don't think that raising the gas tax for a few years during a time when gas is already incredibly expensive and households are being pinched by having to pay increasing transportation costs and are therefore choosing to drive less, I don't see how that's going to actually help the state a whole lot in meeting its transportation goals. So we'll see. And this plan it's passed the Senate, but it's not passed the House, so it's even further away from a done deal this session, so we'll see.
Yeah, I have to say the state budget, particularly given times of tight budgets, it's a good deal. They managed to get money restored for higher education.
That's the general fund budget.
The general fund budget. Higher education is restored. A lot of K-12 education also is restored. We were talking last week about potential co-pays in the basic health plan, Medicaid. And Medicaid transportation and for prescription drugs, and that did not go through. That won't be something that's imposed on the state's poor. So some kudos to the state's Democratic leadership. And let's face it, if we'd had Governor Rossi in office, this whole thing probably would not be coming down the same way. So it's something to remember.
I think that's very true.
If we ever go back to that question again.
Okay. Well, moving a little bit out of state, Portland. Apparently, they're sweeping the FBI out.
Well, they're not getting the FBI out of town. But what they're doing is very interesting. There's a schism that's developed between the city of Portland and the joint federal and local anti-terrorism task force. Now, these task forces have been developed all over the country, some 30 different cities, including in Seattle and Spokane. And in Portland, the police officers within the city that had been assigned to the FBI's anti-terrorism task force are being withdrawn. And they're being withdrawn for a couple of reasons. They're being withdrawn because of concerns about the Patriot Act and its application. Particularly, there was a case last year where a gentleman from the Portland area was falsely accused in the Madrid train bombing. And how the FBI handled that was very much criticized locally. And then also there's a question of the security clearance for the mayor himself, and the mayor saying, well, if I can't know what my police officers are doing, you know, I have to be able to have the same security clearance that my officers have, or you know, I can't properly oversee them. You know, overseeing the police department apparently being something that they care about in Portland as opposed to, say, Seattle. But this is an interesting idea, because I think it would behoove activists who are concerned about civil liberties, who are concerned about racial profiling, who are concerned about the Patriot Act, something that we could perhaps ask the city council and the mayor's office here in Seattle to consider as well, is divorcing ourselves from this joint local and federal anti-terrorism task force, because these anti-terrorism task forces tend to become political. They tend to become task forces that look at, say, the ALF and ELF rather than Al Qaeda.
Or they look at local peace groups.
Or they look at local peace groups.
Using the excuse of following up on ALF and ELF actions.
Yeah, so this is something that I think the model that's being provided by Portland, could be very constructively followed here in Seattle.
You know where they're being withdrawn to?
They're just being.
I was wondering if they're coming up here, because we have a large office, FBI office.
Well,
it's not it's the Portland's police officers are being withdrawn from the task force.
Oh, gotcha. Okay. Thank you.
So, yeah.
I think that's kind of an interesting argument. The mayor needs to be able to oversee the police department. I think that's not only applicable here in Seattle, but maybe also in Tacoma, where they're still fighting over the death of Crystal Brame and the fact that the city did not adequately govern the police department and pay attention to who was actually appointed the police chief.
Yeah.
So I think that's applicable everywhere, not just in Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, that leaves us then with
This Week in Iraq.
There were two main headlines this week in Iraq. First was the death of Marla Ruzicka in a suicide car bombing on the road to the U.S. military base near the Baghdad International Airport. This was covered really widely on TV news here, in newspapers, on the radio, all over the place. It was interesting. She was portrayed as an all-American, 28-year-old blonde California, almost a surfer girl. And isn't it a shame that this sweet little aid worker was killed by this nasty suicide bomber?
Almost dismissively, in some ways.
Yeah, in some ways, it was very strange. In fact, Ruzicka was a longtime activist. She'd been an activist since she was a teenager, and she'd been active in the anti-war movement and in fair trade issues. And she had established her own organization. This was a very dynamic, strong, powerful person who was very, very interested in politics from a very young age. And you didn't get that sense from listening to a lot of the eulogies that were given over her death. She managed to pry, along with the help of many other activists and victims, she managed to pry some $20 million in funding out of the U.S. Congress in order to set up a compensation fund for victims in Afghanistan and Iraq. And it was very interesting, in the last few days of her life, she also managed to pry something else out of the U.S. military, which was an admission by a brigadier general in Baghdad that U.S. troops do, in fact, file a spot report every time they shoot a non-combatant in Iraq. So the U.S. military does, in effect, keep statistics on the number of civilian dead in Iraq, and they simply don't release it. What's interesting is that even now in the left press, following up on this little piece of information that she managed to get from the U.S. military, hasn't been real strong. Nobody has been really complaining, hey, why is the military not releasing this information? Why is this considered classified? Why isn't somebody, you know, making this public? You know, I mean, it's one thing, for example, to have USA Today write kind of a soft editorial about how, gosh, the U.S. government ought to carry on Marla Ruzicka's work. And it's another for the New York Times and the Washington Post to actually assign a reporter to that beat and try to ferret out the same information and try to find out who has made the decision to keep this information secret.
And why?
I think that's another thing that needs to be discussed about Marla Ruzicka's death and should come out of it that hasn't come out of it. Now, the other top headline in Iraq is the kidnapping of 80 to about 150 Shiites in the town of Madain by Sunni insurgents. This was also covered widely on TV here in the United States and in the newspapers. And it came out of rumors that were spread by the main groups that are now in the new government in Iraq. The Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq, their representatives were the first to really shout about this last Friday, to say, oh my God, Sunni insurgents have kidnapped, you know, 15 families or 80 people or 100 people. The numbers kept going up. You couldn't get a good fix on exactly how many people had been kidnapped and were being held hostage by Sunni insurgents in this town of Madain that is a multi-ethnic town and has people of both factions of Islam, both Shiite and Sunni Muslims who live there. So over the weekend, U.S. and Iraqi troops surrounded the town of Madain, excuse me, and they began to conduct raids. And what they found was absolutely nothing. They found no bomb factories, no weapons stocks, no insurgents, no hostages, nothing. They found a sleepy town going about its business. Now, it's interesting that about the same time as that was hitting news reports, the new president of Iraq, Jalal Talabani, came out and said, yes, 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 there were hostages. Yes, there were hostages. In fact, Iraqi police have pulled some 70 bodies, some 50 to 70 bodies out of the Tigris River. So what he was saying had happened was the Sunnis swept into the town of Madain, kidnapped all these people, took them outside of the town, killed them, and dumped their bodies in the river. That's what he was implying. However, only two, and this was dutifully reported by the U.S. press all over the place. However, only two outlets actually bothered to follow up to ask Iraqi police in the area, gosh, did you pull those bodies out of the river? And those two outlets were the BBC and the LA Times, the Los Angeles Times. And what they found when they asked Iraqi police is that the Iraqi police said, well, yeah, we've pulled a lot of bodies out of the Tigris River, but that's been over the course of months. We've pulled about 70 bodies out of the river over the course of several months. Many of them are in badly decomposed or in, you know, bad stages of decay. And we think that, and this is what the Iraqi police told them, they think that these bodies are from people who have been kidnapped over a long period of time on the highways that run from Baghdad south into the Shiite areas, kidnapped not by Sunni insurgents necessarily, but by these roving gangs of criminals who kidnap people, hold them for ransom, and when their relatives don't pay, they kill them. That's become a major industry in Iraq these days, largely because there is no emphasis by the occupying power, the U.S. military, to go after major criminal gangs. So this is the main story, is that there are no Shiite-Sunni ethnic tensions, per se. There was no major kidnapping that went on in Madain. What there is this slow disintegration of the civil authority and slow disintegration of civil society in Iraq that allows these criminal gangs to come in to loot, to steal, to hold people hostage, to kill whenever they please, because they're simply has been a total breakdown in government.
But you also have a very, very high-ranking official making these accusations in a mm-hmm. way that's very polarizing.
Yes, that's the other side of the story, is that at the outgoing government of Ayad Alawi had maintained all along that there was no hostage situation in Madain, as the reporters were, you know, writing these headlines. It was the incoming government, this new government based on factions, really, and returning exiles, that was shouting very loudly about this problem and trying to flame these ethnic tensions. And that's not a good sign for the new government. Who is in the new government? That's another question, something that hasn't been covered very well in the press. We know from the January elections that the main factions in parliament, the Shiites won big, the Kurds got a pretty sizable minority, and Ayad Alawi's party got a very small number of seats, but they're still being courted by the other two groups, the Kurds and the Shiites. What we know also is that there's a partial government so far. You have the assembly elected in January. We have President Jalal Talabani, who's a Kurd, and that's largely a ceremonial post, the post of president. And we have a prime minister, Ibrahim Jafari, of the Shiite coalition that came to power. Jafari is a returning exile, just as Jalal Talabani is, just as Ayad Alawi was. So you can kind of see where this is headed. Once the president was appointed, Jalal Talabani was appointed about a week ago, it triggered a time limit of 2 weeks for the presidential council to appoint a new government, including not just the prime minister, who's already been appointed, but all of the cabinet ministries as well. And there's been a lot of infighting among these various groups over who's going to get the prime spots in the cabinet, particularly the defense ministry, the interior ministry, and the ministries of finance and oil. And so far, there hasn't been a consensus over who's going to get what. It's a little bit like rats fighting over a piece of cheese or something. We'll see. It's not very encouraging for the future, and not very encouraging to the Iraqi people either. So we'll see what happens in upcoming weeks. And that wraps it up for this week in Iraq.
Well, I saw this in this morning's paper. They had an article about that the U.S. Army had completed their investigation, or one of them, into Abu Ghraib and how far up the chain things had gone, and they mm-hmm. said Sanchez didn't go to Sanchez, it stayed with Karpinski.
Yeah. As it turns out, pretty much the Inspector General, the Army Inspector General, has said, "Gosh, no, nobody else but the few underlings that have been disciplined so far is responsible for this problem." In spite of the fact that previous audits and previous investigations have shown that Ricardo Sanchez bears some responsibility for having set up an environment that encouraged this kind of abuse, and even the underlings, some of his underlings who were directly, like Barbara Fast, who was directly in charge of interrogations at Abu Ghraib, even those people escaped any kind of punishment for the scandal. And I think that in itself is scandalous.
Yeah, and don't think Iraqis aren't aware of that.
Yeah, they are paying a lot of attention to this, too.
Well, all of a couple minutes left. We did have a question come in. From Alan, can you develop the idea of a relationship between Seattle school closures, small schools rooted in their neighborhoods, and the two speakers for third world debt relief Mike talked with at 7:30? I know Seattle schools are not funded by World Bank loans yet. Nevertheless, the steady march toward an impoverished world, starving hope, feels like a parallel to me. Any thoughts on that? We had people in talking about the Jubilee movement.
I have a thought on that. There's a group of school districts and and the teachers union, the NEA, are suing the Bush administration for more money to fund No Child Left Behind. I think I think school districts ought to be asking, why the heck can't we get more money from government in general to fund what should be one of the most basic services that government provides its citizens, which is an education? That should be one of the things we should be demanding, not just from the federal government, because the federal government has been the most lax in providing funding for school districts, but also from state and local governments as well.
Yeah, and to pay the people who work in education, because they do one of the most important things in society,
and get paid relatively poorly.
Yep.
All right. Well, talking once again with John Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the State, and tell people where they can find Eat the State.
Eat the State can be found in bookstores, coffee shops, cafes, public libraries, and various other places where you find free publications. We can also be found on the web at www.eatthestate.org.